Our last speaker is Robert Parry. Robert Parry is the editor of Consortium News, the first investigative news magazine on the internet. This site was meant to be a home for important, well-reported stories and a challenge to the inept but dominant mainstream news media of the day. He was one of the reporters who helped expose the Iran-Contra scandal for the Associated Press in the mid-1980s. Consortium News was founded in part due to fears that the decline of the US press corps foreshadowed disasters that would come when journalists failed to alert the public about impending dangers. His title is The Ukraine and the Human Factor: How Propaganda and Passions Can Risk Nuclear Conflagration.
Thank you, Helen. I must say that I had a speech written, but after hearing all this, the comments this morning, I've sort of thrown it out, or at least I've scribbled all over it. So I think I'll just kind of wing it, if you don't mind. You know, as a reporter or journalist, I have a certain perspective on some of these things that's a bit different from the scientists that we've heard. And I do want to pick up on something that Seth was talking about the issue of probability of nuclear war. And he mentioned that there was a greater chance for a nuclear war at a time of crisis. And he said, I think very correctly, that that should drive us to want to reduce the possibility of these kinds of crises. It is, as we see, however, there is a tendency in the way the U.S. political and media system works these days to actually encourage or to try to create crises. Certainly expand on them when they could be easily dismantled or diffused. And obviously a key point right now is Ukraine and how that's been handled. But before I get to that, I think it's important to talk about how, in my time in covering Washington, D.C. since 1977, often for mainstream publications, we've seen how the propaganda system can work in the United States and how it's become really quite clever the way it meshes between politicians and the media and how we've personalized so much of how we see world affairs. It's become a pretty clear point, I think, that one way to get the American people riled up about some foreign conflict is not to talk about the controversy or the difficulties in some distant place, but to demonize some ruler. And we've seen this work very effectively over the past 30-some years, 40 years since I've been around. Ronald Reagan demonized Daniel Ortega in Nicaragua. He was, if you remember, Ortega was the dictator in designer glasses. We personalize it, make it kind of funny. We get people laughing, and then the propagandists can pull in the public and get them to go in the direction they wanted. We saw this with Noriega in Panama, the guy with waving his machete around. We saw this perhaps most determinedly with Saddam Hussein in Iraq, who was, I think George H.W. Bush called him worse than Hitler. And then there were propaganda elements around those things. If you remember in the Persian Gulf War, there were the allegations about Iraqis taking babies off of incubators and killing them. These were essentially fabrications, but they touched the American people and got them into the right mood to go ahead for war. And we've seen this evolve as sort of a regular standard procedure. And now, of course, we're seeing it in connection with Ukraine around Vladimir Putin. And one might say that Mr. Putin makes himself a rather easy target sometimes for being demonized, but still there's this element of ridicule and anger and hatred that often goes beyond what's actually happening. But it's a key way to get the American people to focus on a conflict in a way that gets them very emotional, gets them very angry, and gets them ready to fight. And so in the case of Ukraine, one of the curious things when I started covering this was that it struck me that it wasn't a very difficult issue to resolve. Basically, as actually Der Spiegel did a very good job of this recently in doing a chronology of how this crisis evolved. And basically, if you go back to November of 2013, you had a dispute between involving President Viktor Yanukovych, the elected president of Ukraine. He had been toying with the idea of having an association agreement with the European Union. He was moving ahead on that, but then he was advised by his economic people back in Kiev that to abruptly terminate economic dealings with Russia, their next-door neighbor, would cost Ukraine $160 billion. So he told Chancellor Merkel that he couldn't go ahead at this point. He wanted to keep negotiating, but he had to sort of figure out how to fill this hole. Now, that doesn't seem to be the kind of thing that, it's the sort of thing that political systems are supposed to handle. Yes, some people might think, yes, go ahead. Some people might say, well, let's take our time. Let's see if we can work out a situation where we do business with Europe, but also with Russia. All that would seem kind of reasonable, I suppose. But it certainly upsets some people in Ukraine, and especially in Western Ukraine, where they had ideas that they could become more part of Europe. Of course, people in Eastern Ukraine, the more ethnic Russians, wanted to maintain their ties with their historic relations with Russia. So there was this difference. And in the middle of this, as this political problem was playing out with the Maidan demonstrations, we suddenly see the United States, particularly some of our neoconservatives, jumping into it. We saw Senator McCain speaking to the protesters, speaking from a platform of one of the right-wing parties under a banner honoring Stepan Bandera, who had, for a while at least, during World War II, collaborated with Hitler. And McCain said, the American people are with you. America is with you. We saw the Assistant Secretary of State, Victoria Nuland, going out in passing out cookies. And we learned that she had been in early February of last year, having a conversation with the U.S. Ambassador, Jeffrey Pyatt, about who would be the new leaders of the government. She favored someone named Yats. She says, Yats is the guy. Yats, of course, turned out to be Arseniy Yatsenyuk. And then you saw the crisis get worse. You saw groups from organized often in the western part of Ukraine, some of them very far right, some of them even neo-Nazis, being trained and brought into Kiev, bussed in by the hundreds each day, to change what had been a more or less peaceful demonstration into something more violent. And that led eventually to increased death toll. There was a mysterious sniper attack, which we still don't know exactly who did it, but it was immediately blamed on Yanukovych and his people. And we saw these passions moving up. And it wasn't no longer just an issue of economics, it became sort of a morality play. And in the midst of this, as Yanukovych is essentially driven from power, he and his officials flee the country on February 22nd, then you see the United States moving in very quickly and declaring this the legitimate government of Ukraine. And you see Arseniy Yatsenyuk, Yats, becoming the prime minister. So obviously, this has become a complicated issue, but it was one where the United States, U.S. officials, again, wanted to achieve something. You had people some of these neoconservatives who have survived inside the Obama administration. Some of them have actually gone ahead, and they certainly are supported by the think tanks, some of which we've talked about, and they are supported by much of the media. And this has become... So suddenly the issue of Ukraine became a morality play. We had our good guys, we had our bad guys. Yanukovych was the bad guy. There was even a badder guy named Vladimir Putin. And this is, so instead of it being something that could be handled, where there could be some federalized system or there could be some arrangement where it could work out, we ended up with the United States and Russia facing off in what became known as Cold War II. And it began over something, as I said, that was not particularly difficult for a political system to handle. But it was brought into this propaganda structure, and it was brought in with the idea of turning Putin into something, as Hillary Clinton compared him to Hitler. And then there was talk about how he really had plans to sort of conquer Europe. He was going to take the Baltic states back and rebuild the Soviet Union. There's, by the way, no evidence of any of this. There's no intelligence. There's nothing that supports these claims. But this became conventional wisdom in Washington. Even Henry Kissinger, in an interview with Der Spiegel, said, why would Putin have been doing the Sochi Olympics, trying to show, spending $40 billion to show how much he wanted Russia to be part of the West and part of the world system, and then turn around and try to cause trouble in Ukraine? It made no sense. But it became groupthink, and Washington is well known for its groupthink. We've seen the groupthink work as it did back in 2002 and 2003 in terms of everyone believing there were weapons of mass destruction in Iraq, and we saw the consequences. And we've seen this happen over and over again in Washington. It gets to these points about no adult supervision. It's sort of like it's almost like some kind of animal house where people have sort of they start having fun, and before you know it, things get out of hand and people start dying. The difference with Ukraine, however, is that it's on Russia's border. And that leads you to a very difficult possible situation where if you have a situation where there's where the Russians feel under pressure, the Americans feel that they're on the right, there are two conflicting narratives. The American narrative is that the Russians are the aggressors, that they're the ones causing all the trouble. The Russian view is that the Americans have been pushing NATO closer and closer to their borders, that they're the ones under pressure, they're the ones being threatened. I'm told by one of my sources who has good ties in Moscow that the Russians are absolutely paranoid about the possibility of cruise missiles being placed somewhere in Ukraine. They were particularly worried about Sebastopol, their historic port on the Crimea. It was one of the reasons that they moved in when the Crimeans said they wanted out of Ukraine and annexed Crimea, so they could maintain Sebastopol. So you have these fears. You have these two sets of fears, or two narratives, and they have the danger of putting these two countries at a point of making the next miscalculation. We've already seen how this works. There was someone apparently made a miscalculation and shot down Malaysian Airline Flight 17 last July 17th, which further aggravated this situation. The Americans immediately blamed it on the Russians. They blamed it on the Russian rebels and said that the Russian government had provided these missiles to shoot down the plane. I'm told by people from connections to the CIA that some analysts at the agency don't believe that to be the case, that they were basically opposing that as an argument. They could not find evidence that the Russians had provided those missiles. So, and they believed that it was some rogue element of the Ukrainian forces involved. Now, so it's still a mystery. We still don't quite know who did what, but instead of waiting for the facts, we jump to conclusions. And that became, and that again drove this narrative. It drove this idea that Putin was this very dangerous figure who had to be stopped at all costs. And you even saw magazine covers like Der Spiegel saying, "Stop Putin now." You saw him being presented as some kind of vampire. Someone showed me that even The Economist this month has Russia's Putin's war on the West. Now, Putin's view, of course, is sort of opposite. He thinks the West is at war with him. And when you have these two situations, it becomes sort of easier to understand how you get to nuclear war. Because you have two nuclear states, you have many people in Washington now talking very openly about arming the Ukrainian military. You have the Ukrainian military talking about attacking and fighting the Russians. And you have this support really across the American political spectrum. It's not just Tommy Friedman of the New York Times who's talking about this sort of thing. It's also Nicholas Kristof, who's considered kind of humanitarian liberal. He did a piece last year about how what the Ukrainians need from us are guns. And to take on the Russians, to go kill the Russian bear, as he put it. So now you have the situation growing increasingly dangerous. And the possibility becomes that there will be future miscalculations. There was, just a week ago, one of the senior officials of the Ukrainian government was speaking with Canada's CBC. And here's what he said. This is Ukrainian Deputy Foreign Minister Vadim Pristeko. He told Canada's CBC that Ukraine wants to have, quote, a full-scale war against Russia. Christakia explained, quote, "Everybody is afraid of fighting with the nuclear state. We are not anymore in Ukraine. However dangerous it sounds," he said, "we have to stop Putin somehow." So when you get to that kind of passion and that kind of excessive language and that kind of dare the torpedoes approach, what you end up with is a situation where you could very easily slide into the next series of miscalculations, and the next. And the Russians may feel that they are about to be attacked. And as Seth put it, I mean, if in those kinds of moments, it becomes more reasonable to expect you're going to be attacked. And so if you see a blip on the screen showing that maybe it's a nuclear bomb or a nuclear missile that's been fired at you, you're more likely to react. And vice versa. The Americans are going to be more tense about this because they know the Russians are feeling paranoid and are at risk. So what you encounter is that we create a situation where nuclear war is not something that is just an abstraction. It becomes something that could actually happen. What's been most distressing to me, I would say, about covering Washington during this period is that there's a cavalier, goofy quality to so much of what the journalists and the media are doing, and the politicians as well. Kind of a one-upsmanship. I can be more aggressive than you. I can, if you say you want to do this with the Russians, I'm going to do this with the Russians. And there's almost a bidding of tough talk and tough guyism and some tough galism too. I mean, it was Hillary Clinton who was the first one to start comparing Putin to Hitler this time. So I guess the point I'm trying to make and what I've been doing, what some of our work at Consortium News has been focused on in the last year or so, has been trying to write this story honestly, trying to tell it from both sides. It used to be a part of my profession that we believed, and sometimes it's not true, but we believed that there are always two sides of a story. And you're supposed to at least seek out the other side of the story and represent it fairly. Even if you don't like the people, you're supposed to represent it fairly. I used to cover death squads in Central America. I've interviewed Roberto Dobiusan. I dealt with the Tonton Macoute in Haiti. I didn't like these people, but it was a case of always trying to hear what their side was and understand it. And that was the job, I thought, of a journalist, to present both sides of a story honestly. And by doing so, give the American people the chance to then reflect back onto their politicians with a full understanding of what's at stake. Not to be led, not to be corralled, not to be, the phrase that they like to use in Washington, perception management. The point of what the U.S. government's been doing for so long now has been sort of captured in that phrase, perception management. They feel that the job, especially after the Vietnam War, when the American people got kind of out of control, the idea of how do you bring them back into line with the policies of a more warlike position in the world, a more militaristic position. And so they set to work, and they set to work aggressively during the Reagan years. They brought in the CIA. Walter Raymond Jr. was the top propagandist at the agency. He was brought into the National Security Council. He set up interagency task force on how to, as they said, manage our perceptions. And they've done a pretty good job of it. And what's been also happening along those lines is that as the years have gone on, the American news media has increasingly fallen into line, increasingly become a force to project, to reflect that perception management strategy rather than to contest it, and not to provide the American people an objective, fair, honest, full accounting of what's going on, but to tell you what's necessary to get you to support what they want to do in the first place. And I have to say that one of the worst places for this, in this recent round anyway, has been the New York Times. The New York Times has been utterly disgraceful in how it has presented the Ukraine story. It is one-sided. You read these stories, they reek of bias. I could say the Washington Post has been no better. That's certainly true, but that's not saying much these days. The Washington Post has become essentially a neoconservative newspaper and promotes neoconservative views. And the New York Times has increasingly moved that way, too. And I kind of understand it as a journalist that you're always looking out for your career. You don't want to be out of step. You want to make sure you get that promotion. You don't get fired. You don't get put on the overnight desk, whatever they can do to us. So you play ball. But playing ball in a case like this, especially, it's bad enough to do it on Iraq or on Panama or on Grenada or on Nicaragua or some other sad country. But to do it now on the border of nuclear-armed Russia and to not understand the dangers that you're putting the world into and the American people into, it seems at some point your career is not that important. Anyway, I do want to thank you and thank Helen for this opportunity.
Thank you much, Robert. As you spoke at the end, I was reminded of Goebbels. Every time Hitler invaded another country, what Goebbels did was take over all the media and the women's magazines. So that's what's kind of going on now, isn't it?